Hey everyone, this amazing ESO Network show is brought to you by our fine sponsor, Amazon.com. Please remember to shop Amazon for all your geeky needs, no matter what time of the year it is. All you need to do is go to ESOpodcast.com/ESOAmazon or click on the Amazon banner on the ESO Network webpage to go to our e-store. It's the best way to shop and the best way to support this program, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. Okay, that's enough of me babbling for now. Now on with your regular scheduled show.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Welcome to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast dedicated to all things sci-fi, fantasy, and much, much more. Sit back and relax and enjoy the show.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Earth Station 1 podcast. We are here live at Dragon Con! And yes, folks, it's time to feel old. It is the 35th anniversary of Blade Runner. Ooh, exactly. The movie that's supposed to take place 3 years from today. So I think we have a lot of catching up to do, and I think we have a great crew to talk all about it. My name is Mike Faber. I am the host of the Earth Station 1 podcast, and welcome to the panel. And let's go from this side. Want to introduce yourself?
Good evening. My name is Philip Schweier. I am a comic book journalist. I write for Back Issue Magazine, comicbookbin.com, and I'm also one of the organizers of GnomeCon down in Savannah. First weekend in March. Come see us.
I'm Mike Langford, better known as Professor Satire. I do a comedy bit called Professor Satire's Sci-Fried Sideshow. This tomorrow at 4, if you come to the university room in the Hyatt, you'll see Ed Wood's Blade Runner. Can you prove Decker isn't a replicant?
Interesting.
That's tomorrow at 4.
Mr. Gordon?
Howdy.
Howdy.
Thank you. I am Mike Gordon. I am the other co-host of the Earth Station 1 weekly podcast. I am also a comic creator, writer, and publisher. I've got a table in Artist Alley. We are in row G, table 3, 3G. Yes, that's right. And we have just got an ESO publication, a new ESO publication, The Tales of the Station, Volume 2. Woo-hoo! Making its debut this weekend, so very happy that some of the writers are in attendance as well. We've got one spouse, right, and
two.
Right,
and me,
right. Wrote the foreword, I wrote the afterword, and edited the book. And yes, you can get copies of that at my table. So come on by.
And I approved.
Scott's story is brilliant.
Thank you.
And my husband's story has a space chicken.
And we're shocked how.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Scott Begay, Dr. Geek of Dr. Geek's Laboratory, to be found on the ESO Network.
Hi, Dr. Geek.
Hello. And where we explore science inspired by fiction. And I'm also a proud author of one of the stories in Volume 1 and Volume 2.
Ow!
Wow.
Hi, I'm Tegan Henderson. I am a podcaster, a general geek. I also am in a video game orchestra up in the Washington, D.C. area from where I hail. And I am the token person who has only recently watched Blade Runner for the first time. Oh, and before you ask, it was the final cut. All right. That's why I'm here.
Well, that's the great thing with Blade Runner, basically, there's 2 zillion different cuts.
There's a version for everyone.
You know, you wanted a version, you could have it almost catered to yourselves for Blade Runner. I actually saw Blade Runner, and this is showing how old I was, I saw it in the theater the first time. And I want to see by a show of hands here in the audience, because we do interactive. We're going to get you guys involved with this. How many people actually saw it the first time in the theaters?
Wow.
Wow.
Impressive.
That's impressive. because it didn't do that great at the theater when it came out. So this is pretty much everyone.
Everybody saw it, right?
Everybody that saw it's here.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's interesting because Blade Runner is not your typical science fiction story. And it has so many different levels and meanings in the film. It could be taking place today. It could be taking place thousands of years from now. And it's just, it's beautiful in so many different levels based on a short story. And it's just, it's great.
How many people have read the short story?
That's where it's about to go. Okay.
I read Do Androids.
What's that?
Do Androids Dream of Electricity?
Sure. Philip K. Dick. And
do androids dream of electric sheep?
And it's really neat to see the differences between the adaptation of the book all the way up to the movie. Mm-hmm. When I saw the movie, because I had read the book in high school, and it was when I saw Blade Runner, because I had heard it was coming out on film, and you know, Harrison Ford, oh, that's going to be great. It wasn't anything what I expected. Mm-hmm. It was stunningly beautiful, completely.
Philip K. Dick said that he sympathized with the story. He wouldn't say that it was, like, totally his story, but he said he could see somebody really enjoying it after having read his story, or his novel, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So he was really into it. He saw a rough cut of some of the special effects footage, and he got really excited about it. Trouble is, he died very shortly after.
Oh, so he never saw the final product?
Never saw the final film.
Wow.
I was going to say, I'm not sure we've seen the final film.
So. Yeah.
Never saw the original cut.
Right.
It's interesting because Decker is such a great character, and he's the central focus of it. And there's so many questions around him and what he brings to it. And it's just, it's great. When I saw it, I was still a teenager, and I had never seen anything like this. I don't think many people had. And it was, when I saw it, it was like, because for when you're thinking about the future, I didn't ever think so dark and so dreary and so rainy and, you know, such almost bleak in some ways compared to Star Trek or something like that, where the rock
2001,
yeah, 2001 even, you know, you had more of a bright future there. And that was what's great about Blade Runner. It opened my eyes to a whole nother way.
The whole idea of the dystopian future or the film noir in the sci-fi genre, actually, that was my first exposure to that. And once I learned about the noir genre, I'm like, oh, well, clearly, this is what they're pulling. You know, she's representing this character, and he's the, you know, the loyal detective and mm-hmm. all that sort of stuff, and it fit so well. You know, the fact that they're dealing with androids almost doesn't matter. They could, the genre lent itself to it.
Well, you've seen it so done so many different times, Sam Spade films and, you know, Mickey Spillane, all that kind of stuff. But that was my introduction to it.
Yeah.
It opened my eyes to that kind of stuff. And Ridley Scott captured it really well.
Yeah. And then, of course, I mean, the set design and the special effects and the music. Oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm. You cannot think of Blade Runner without Vangelis and that the themes and the music. And just the whole environment.
Yeah, the music really blew me away. Because, again, I just watched it a few months ago for the first time. It was one of those things, like, you know, as a nerd, as a geek coming to conventions, you know, people are like, you know, you talk about the movies you've seen, the movies that really shaped you. And then you talk about the movies you haven't seen. And then people kept looking at me sideways because I had not yet seen Blade Runner. Like, I remember writing this lengthy post about having not yet seen Blade Runner. I was, like, waiting for, like, the perfect moment to finally watch Blade Runner. And then I invited friends over. They brought their kids because it was time for their kids to see it. So it was this thing. And I had never heard the music for Blade Runner until I watched the movie. And I'm like, this score is amazing. Yep. Where has this been all of my life? Oh,
well,
right.
It took about 25 years before they released the full version, so, you know.
Yeah.
It's a fire guy.
It was amazing.
It was interesting. Outside of there, you know, anyone out there, in the audience, how many of you had, you know, seen it later, just recently? Is it for their first time?
First time.
You're in good company.
How many people here have never seen Blade Runner?
Whoa.
This is going to...
Okay.
This is going to... Okay.
We love you anyway, Elizabeth.
I was
going to
say, this is going to contain some spoilers.
The movie is older than I am, so...
I was going to say, another group that might be interesting is I saw for the first time after Battlestar Galactica. Because that's what James almost said.
Yeah.
It's a sequel to BSG. Well, it's over, so now I'll watch it. So I don't have anybody else.
I don't see it. I don't see that.
When one of my first Dragon Cons, Edward James almost specifically talked in his one-on-one about the connections he saw between Blade Runner and Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah,
why
that.
He hadn't done any science fiction in between those two. But he
not.
Saw it as asking the same questions.
Yes.
About
Right. Humanity,
what it means to be human.
I can see that.
Based on contrast with the artificial life in the Westworld.
Well, exactly. No, now that you bring it up, I see it, but I never once thought that. What's up?
Sorry, I had a class in college where we read the book and then watched the movie after, and out of 30 people, only myself and I, or another guy, had seen the movie. Almost everyone in the room liked the book better, and it blew my mind because I loved it so much. But the book is like maybe first 10 minutes of the movie are the book, then the rest of the movie goes off.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't understand that, but they like the cerebralness of
the book. Well, that's a great question. Anyone in here liked the book more than the movie? Other than Elizabeth, who hasn't seen the movie.
I've only read the graphic novel, The Android.
Right. Because actually, that was my introduction to it. I read Marvel Comics did an adaptation of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I saw the movie for the first time. I read the comic, and I said, I've got to see this movie. And then I dragged my parents into it. My dad loved it. My mom fell asleep. So.
What struck me was in the book, the author is almost completely unsympathetic towards the replicants. It takes pains to show the replicants have no capacity for empathy and what the consequences of that is. Whereas the film works better if you do empathize with the replicants and kind of see Roy Batty as the hero.
Well,
and in the movie, they do show empathy. I mean, they most certainly do.
Yeah,
they do, especially with the guy who... The toy guy.
Sebastian.
Yeah. They totally show empathy with him. And that's where you start feeling for the replicants. And then at the end with Roy.
Daryl.
And it's just, I know, Daryl and brother Daryl.
Yeah.
Larry is still building toys.
Yeah.
Daryl and Carol.
That's awesome.
So it's just interesting. What are your guys' thoughts on the look and feel of this?
The look of this movie, the cinematography, the sets, the costumes, the whole design of this movie changed everything. I mean, it really did. I mean, we're still seeing movies that are looking to this movie as a sort of basis for how you... I mean, back then, like, I remember, even things like Max Headroom, Max Headroom series, could have been shot in Los Angeles, at that time.
Dystopian feel.
Right. There was just everything was, all of a sudden it was dark, and all of a sudden there was, there was a mixture of all sorts of races. There was, neon everywhere. There was these plastic umbrellas. There was people eating sushi. There was, everything that was in the movie.
Before the movie, Mike.
No. But, I mean, in movies. You just didn't see people eating sushi in movies until after Blade Runner, and then all of a sudden everybody was eating sushi. It's
even Breakfast Club, they had sushi, and that was after Blade Runner.
Exactly.
Same world.
Same world. They were all the Breakfast Club is all replicants.
Okay, what's up?
It's like you were saying about the influence of the look and how iconic the sets are and stuff. Ready Player One has a huge set piece in the Blade Runner world.
Yeah.
Oh yes, very much so. I'm looking forward to that movie. And please don't let's be disappointed.
Well, speaking of, I know it's too early to mention it, but I will go right ahead and do so because I like spoiling things. I think the sequel looks amazing. The Blade Runner sequel, when I see the trailer for that, and I saw it before Dunkirk, so I saw it in 70mm in IMAX.
Ooh.
And let me tell you, I got goosebumps because the music came on. all the cinematography in that trailer anyway looks like it was shot back then. It just looks beautiful. I have no idea if the story is going to be good or not, but I can tell you that they've done everything they can for the look and feel of it. So, and I think we're probably better off if Ridley Scott doesn't direct the sequel. So, at least that's my personal opinion. But,
hopefully, don't have any narration at the beginning.
Well, you know what? The narration. Look,
30 minutes of narration would be awesome.
I'm going to tell you that I'm a fan of the idea of the narration because I know. Okay, so there's two. Controversies about Blade Runner, at least, right? One is the narration. Which version do you like, the narration or the non-narration? And then the other is, of course, and we'll get into it, I'm sure, whether Deckard is a replicant or not. But as far as the narration goes, I'm a fan of the idea of the narration. What happened was, I think, though, because film noir, right? I mean, film noir has a history of using narration like that, and it was good. The problem was, I think, it was written poorly, and by the time that Harrison went to do it, you can just tell he just didn't care. So it's flat. It sounds awful. It tells, like, the most irritating thing is the one where, like, he kicks, like, at the end where he kicks over the origami, and then all of a sudden you hear, Dax had been there. It's like, yeah, we got that. Thanks for explaining that. Like, it just was awful the way that was done.
Kept it obvious.
But exactly. But I think the idea of it was in par with the style of the film that they were going for. I just wish it had been executed better. Well, so once it's eliminated, I didn't mind it, but I like the idea of it.
Just quickly, I can't remember where I read this, but it's been claimed that Harrison Ford just took great offense to the whole thing of the whole idea of the narration, and he purposely did it poorly so they would drop it.
And you know what? Shame on him for that. He's paid to do a job.
He's an actor.
Right.
Exactly.
Like, he should have put as much into that as anything that he did, right? And I know that he and Ridley weren't getting along as well then. I mean, this was a hard, hard movie to make. It was very difficult. There was a lot of pressure on the studio. Ridley had already been in fights with the studio about trying to get a final cut. There was a lot of stuff going on about that. The music was a contention. I remember, didn't they hire someone else originally to do the music?
Yep. And then it took 25 years to actually come up with a soundtrack.
Yeah.
It was in litigation from word go. I mean, it was all sorts of problems.
Very difficult. And yeah, Harrison and Ridley just did not get along in the making of it.
But what do we got?
Yeah, just going on the point of the audio. There is actually audio, and I think some people found it on YouTube, where you can really hear Harrison Ford just going, this is crap. He's just flat as anything, and actually they only made the voiceover because in the first screening, when the cards came in and the audience said they did not understand any of it. Now, the strange thing is, if you watch Dangerous Days, and I'm sure most people have, Hanson Fancher does say that there was a voiceover in his original script, but it slowly got dropped. And it was only after this first test screening, Warner Brothers wanted it in. And it was always Bud Yorkin who was pulling on the purse strings, not Warner Brothers himself.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Over there? Sir? The beer?
Actually, I was going to mention the same thing he did about Harrison Ford saying in an interview that he didn't want to do the narration, so he did that.
Gotcha.
And it does tie in, like I said, the reason that they did feel that there should be narration is that it does tie into the fact that test audiences were not really sure what happened at the end, and there was some questions about, the studio was not really comfortable, the producers weren't really comfortable with the idea that it was left open that Deckard was a replicant. So it does kind of tie into that sort of, the theory whether or not he is or isn't in the movie. I'll be kind of curious. It looks like from the sequel we get an answer as to whether or not he is or isn't, but because he's old.
Yeah.
Oh, first of all...
Unless he didn't have an incept date.
First of all, he didn't have an incept date. Second of all, Do androids grow old?
Do they look like ask Brent Spiner.
So, oh, Deckard himself has
a... Well, there's a short story leading up to 2049, and Jared Leto's character.
Yeah.
Talk louder. Talk louder, we can't hear you.
There's a short story, a short video that just came out earlier this week. It's 6 minutes long. Jared Leto's character is in it, and he's discussing that he can, for the right price, put any type of length of life for...
Gotcha.
That doesn't answer whether or not they grow old, right. But it could answer, you know, the fact that it's 30 years later.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They're making three of them, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah, there'd be two more.
I'm of the camp also that I don't like the idea that he is. So I'll say that. So anybody else?
Round of applause for that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting.
I like the idea that he's human.
When I first, the first
you're
probably
more
10 years of me seeing it, because, you know, when it came out on the different versions, I hadn't even heard the theory that he was a replicant. And then all of a sudden, probably 15, 20 years after the movie came out, that's when I was at a con and I was at a Blade Runner panel, and they said, "Oh yeah, it's obvious that Decker's is a you know, a replicant," and I was just like, "What?" And it's just like I was like floored, and I see it. There's hints at it now, but I didn't see it back then.
You
and
mean
it,
the fact that the numbering is off?
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, it bothered me from day one. I was sitting there going like, "But wait a minute, if you add it up, it doesn't count."
What's the origin, really, of this theory? I just had to ask.
Yeah.
Does anyone know for sure?
I was introduced to this... I think it's the numbering.
Yeah.
I was introduced to this film in college by my boyfriend at the time, who was... The director's cut hadn't come out yet, but he was solidly of the opinion that Deckard was a replicant because...
He wasn't into
that.
Chickens, right?
Hmm?
He wasn't into chickens.
He was not into chickens.
Okay.
He pointed out
all the clues in the movie, and then when the director's cut came out, I was... convinced because of the addition of the unicorn dream and the unicorn origami,
right.
Tying into the unicorn origami. But after watching the final, the special features on the final cut with the deleted scene where there was another replicant, who they're all, the other replicants are mourning,
right.
I became convinced in the other direction.
Right, and all of a sudden that's where the missing replicant is,
yeah.
Right? I like the idea that Deckard's life is just as dreary as if he was one.
Yeah.
I, you know, that he doesn't really have much family. He doesn't have really any memories to hang on to. His life is really work and go back to that apartment. And,
yeah.
And you know, basically, you know, for me, looking at it that way, it was like, well, what's the difference between artificial life and real life? What does it really matter if he's more or less a replicant?
There was a novel written, published, actually, back in the mid-90s, supposedly a sequel to Blade Runner, where they address the misnumbering of the replicants. And, you know, what's the explanation for that? I read it. It's very disappointing because their explanation was that when Bryant said that, he was drunk. He misspoke. And I'm like, they wrote a novel for this? They wasted those trees? What's wrong with these knuckleheads? So,
wasn't it a legitimate continuity error?
I
don't think it was originally intended to be a clue for anything. It was,
I don't
it
know, but I think Ridley's gone on record as saying that he believes that he's a replicant.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he probably put that in it.
Yeah. For me, when I first saw it in 1982, I went with the Deckard as a replicant. The big scene that gives it away is... when between him and Rachel, when he walks behind Rachel and he's blurred and he looks at the camera and you can see the glow in his eyes, that you only to that point associated with the replicants. However, this May, I saw it again on the big screen and it did suddenly make you realise, no, he's not a replicant. He's actually too self-aware to be a replicant. And like I said, suddenly, isn't it amazing? After 35 years, you've thought one way, you've viewed it in one way, and then suddenly, oh my God, it just comes at you, blinding, how wrong you feel.
You know what, on that note...
I like her, she's good.
I will say that, I didn't watch it in the theater when it came out. So the first time I saw it was on cable at the time, maybe HBO or some pay service like that. And it was on TV, so it was pan and scan, right? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't letterboxed, and so I watched it, and I enjoyed it, I loved it, still one of my favorite movies of all time, and it was good enough that, you know, it didn't ruin the movie for me. However, the one thing that really bugged me was the scene where he analyzes the photograph. I was like, this doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. And the first time I saw it on the big screen, and I could see the full version of what was going on when he was analyzing the photograph.
We can't hear them.
Gotcha. I just stood up in the theater and went, now it makes sense!
You know, this gentleman has a Nexus 6 Tyrell Corporation t-shirt. I just thought maybe Decker is Nexus 7.
Right.
And it's hard to tell whether he is a replicant because he's so advanced.
Well, yeah, but he's been around longer than the Sixes have. So he would have to be an earlier model.
We don't know that. It could be
implanted memories.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. But I mean, you've got a lot of characters that have known him longer than that, that interact with him in the course of the movie.
You assume.
How many puppets of him can they make?
Brian and Gaff, that's it.
They could also have different versions.
That's
of
a lot
him.
Of people.
You know, you know, you can't.
Do they duplicate it? Copy
off. All right. See now. Okay.
You can't tell what's real. Just like now.
Yeah. And you know what? I don't knock the theory. I just don't subscribe to it myself. Yeah.
I find that that Deckard as a replicant is also
louder.
Deckard as a replicant is also it's an emotional letdown as a viewer.
We heard the first part.
Deckard as a replicant is an emotional letdown because he spends so much time throughout the movie. Part of what you're saying is that if he is a human, he's acting very non-human. He's cold and callous towards Rachel. She even goes so far to ask if he's taken the test on himself.
Right.
And to me, that's not a clue to him being a replicant. It's a clue to him being a very poor human being. And it takes the moment of a replicant saving him at the end, sparing his life, for him to become human. And that is you get the cold chills. For me, that's that. If Deckard is a replicant, that emotional impact is gone. It just vanishes entirely. So we can talk about proof and what's real and what's not. The narrative of the story misses the mark to me if he's a replicant.
Yeah, good call.
Yeah, that's good.
The replicants seem to want to enjoy life. That's why they're so upset. And Decker just seems to want to end it all. He just hates this whole existence. He seems bored and
exhausted.
Just going through the motions.
He seems like he's seen so much, kind of like Roy, but from the opposite angle.
Right, yeah.
And so basically, they're almost like the same coin, but two different sides. And Decker's worn out because he has to keep on eradicating these replicants that go rogue, to say. And he's worn out from doing it, and he's been doing it for years and years and years, where Roy now has gone out to the edges of the solar system and seen things that people have only dreamed about seeing, and now he just wants a normal life here on Earth and everything. He wants to live his life now. Instead of being somebody's slave.
Can I just say, as someone who had never watched the movie before, who'd only seen clips of Roy's famous speech at the end on YouTube and stuff, or seen references to it, actually being able to sit through, watch the movie, and see it within context, you're like, man, why hasn't Rutger Hauer's career trajectory been worthy of Rutger Hauer?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Fair enough. Like, just that whole speech and knowing that it was largely improvised because Rutger Hauer thought the script for that moment was crap. So he just do his thing, and it was just magical seeing that finally after all these years watching this, and you're just like, man, Rutger Hauer has deserved better. This man deserves so much better just from that performance alone. Not to mention Lady Hawk, but that's another story.
That's another panel.
But yeah, no, that was just so good.
Yes, it is. And just going back...
We can hear you. Wow.
Going back to the gentleman's, what he was saying about Deckard and Batty, I mean, during the fight scene at the end, as we're going to drum to its close, Batty actually says to him, aren't you supposed to be the good man?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, against that. But my own personal theory, the one that I that kept with me, that I developed, is that when I thought that Deckard was a replicant, didn't necessarily mean he was a Tyrell replicant. Who's got to say that there are not more companies making replicants, except Tyrell make the best ones? Hence the reason why they go on the off-world. They have these off-world contracts. They become the soldiers, the pleasure models, and so on.
No.
You have just opened up the world even more.
Wow. No, that's true, because you only see one company, and there could be, like, automotives or computers. There's multiple companies.
The other companies just couldn't pay for product placement in the movie.
Exactly.
Well, the other companies are making snakes.
Why did it have to be snakes?
Yes.
This could be one of the more intriguing elements of Blade Runner 2049, because the trailer and the footage that we've seen so far do not say that Jared Leto's character is actually of the Tyrell Corporation.
That's true.
So when, of course, Roy kills Eldon Tyrell, who's not to say that it really opened up some kind of corporate power vacuum and other companies possibly came in to take them over?
Absolutely.
The short that came out earlier this week kind of implies that he's not with Tyrell.
Oh, interesting.
What's up?
I teach Blade Runner to my AP seniors.
Oh, cool. Cool.
And,
hold that thought for 2 seconds.
Cut came out.
Start over.
Okay. I teach Blade Runner in my AP, my advanced placement senior English class.
Right.
And when the final cut came out, I used to show the, I guess it's the European cut, years and years ago, until before the final cut came out. When the final cut came out, with the placement of the unicorn scene, that seemed to me solidify the fact that he was a replicant. And the fact that Ridley Scott said he was a replicant. But it was a few years ago, one of my students suggested that because there's all this veiling of the eyes, you know, the eyes are one way to detect, you know, the way to detect the replicant. If you look at most of the people, even in the background sceneries, they always have their eyes covered, even with sunglasses or smoke or all of them wearing veils. That student suggested that maybe the replicants actually outnumber the humans, or the whole world may be
recognized
at this point.
Wow. Could I ask this gentleman a question? How does Blade Runner go over with high school seniors today?
Well, with my AP students, I mean, they love it.
They're smarter. That's a couple.
They love the ambiguity, you know, especially by the end.
I always thought that when they placed the unicorn scene in there, I just thought that Ridley Scott got the footage mixed up with Legend. I just thought... I just thought he was like, oh, I got this snippet. Yeah. What movie am I editing again?
Well, I had always heard the rumor that the scene at the very end where they show the snowfield and everything, wasn't that from young Sherlock Holmes?
I thought it was from Shining.
Shining, was it? Yeah. Okay, but I knew it was from another movie.
It definitely is from The Shining, yeah.
So it's just like... It just didn't fit. It was like...
It was unused footage from the beginning of The Shining that was put at the end of Blade Runner.
Great. So Decker's going to go meet Jack Nicholson. Got it.
Well, it could be worse. I mean, he could have dreamed, like, instead of the unicorn, he could have used footage of Tom Cruise. And Deckard's dreaming of Tom Cruise. Like, what's...
Tom Cruise is a guy.
He never ages. But he does break his ankle. No.
Not often enough.
Thanks. True. True. But, you know, what other questions do you guys have about...
Who are some of your other favorite characters? We talked about Deckard a lot. So, yes. And of course, you know...
Rachel?
Any Rachel fans?
Yeah. J.F. Sanderson.
Yeah.
Yes, J.F. Sebastian. I give her the names next to...
James Olmos, year before last, I think, here at Dragontown. I say to him that I always wanted to know more about his character. But there was a story there that hadn't been told.
Right.
I'd like to see him getting some movie. Can he agree to say
yes? James Thomas, he died from 2 years ago.
Right.
And I said I always wanted to know more about his character. It seems to be a story now.
That there's more to the character.
That's a spin-off that I would have paid to see.
I think, that's as a general rule for me, that's a sign of a great movie. And when all the characters are so well-developed that each one of them you would like to see do a spin-off, like, or some other story about them. And I think that's true of multiple characters in Blade Runner. I mean, sure, Deckard and the replicants get a lot of the focus, thank you. But a lot of, Tyrell himself and the Toymaker guy. Like, I just would like to see, a series with him,
Edward James Olmos created a lot of the dialogue that he used in the film, just improvised it out of some little snippets of words in Hungarian and several other languages.
Not a lot of respect for the written script.
Funny how that worked that way. Go ahead, sir. Hold on. Microphone.
When I watch the movie, too, I see Gaff as a replicant because Gaff's like a mistake. And he walks with a limp and his eyes,
color.
Yeah.
That's a possibility. I thought about that. That maybe he was one that, a rejected one or something like that.
And he's always following Deckard. That seems to go with the idea that maybe Deckard's a replicant. Yeah. Wherever Deckard is, he shows up like he's watching Deckard the entire story.
Could it be that all the Blade Runners are replicants? I mean, they do say about Holden in the beginning, he's okay if nobody unplugs him.
Maybe it takes a replicant to know a replicant and to catch a replicant. Could be.
Maybe.
Yep.
So, the characters are great and all, but in my personal opinion, I'm far less interested in learning more about any of the characters than I am in just being able to spend more time in the world.
I thought the same thing.
The thing that broke me into Blade Runner was just the aesthetic and the world building of it. And as great as the characters are, the thing that stands out the most for me is that.
Did anybody play the video game?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. No, I remember, I just recently watched it for the first time. And being able to see it and be like, oh, I see where all these other movies get their look from. Like, this is just so terrible, formative and terribly iconic. And yes, I want to see more of this world. This is the world that gave birth to so many other similar worlds. That was just really magical.
If you think about it, it was one of the first movies that actually showed Western culture being taken over by Eastern culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So significantly.
Definitely.
I want to know, in 2 years' time, are we going to have floating billboards?
Well, we now have the moving digital billboards.
I know, right?
So I think it's just a matter of time.
All you have to do is put that on a blimp and we're good.
If you think about it, Clockwork Orange is kind of similar. It's Britain in the future sometime being taken over by the Soviet Union or Russia.
So,
okay. No, but in a kind of a Firefly kind of way, it's the East meets West kind of mix.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Shiny, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi. I just wanted to go back to the beginning of the panel for 1 second.
All right. We could start over completely.
Exactly.
Okay.
Howdy!
When we're talking about setting and atmosphere, I heard y'all talk about how groundbreaking it was, and I heard a mention of the word dystopia, and one of the things that I think of when I see this film is that I feel that it's short of dystopia. It's more like a really run-down future. And I'm just sort of curious to know what you guys see as the long arm of influence of this film in creating a noir of kind of a run-down future. Thank you.
I think it was one of the first times that I had seen where we had developed in a fictional world where we had off-world capabilities, but the home planet had gone to hell. Like, it seemed more adventurous, more luxurious, advantageous to live off-world than actually on the home planet. Like, we had basically ruined Earth And, you know, if you really wanted to make a name for yourself,
you would leave.
You would leave, right.
Sebastian says he's not healthy enough to go.
Right. Like, the people that are left on Earth are the people that can't afford to leave. They're the people who are left behind. They're, you know, the rejects. And it just, it was really a depressing look at, like, where Earth is. Mm-hmm. I mean, usually when science fiction, Earth is like the home headquarters of the Empire or the Federation, you know?
Except for the Earth that was.
Yeah. So that sort of opened the door to that sort of, because after that we got all sorts of things like that, I think, you know. I think, you know, was it Babylon 5 that came after that, where all of a sudden there was a series where Earth was not really, you know, the place that we wanted it to be, you know, that kind of thing.
Isn't it a little suspicious, though, that they have to have these blimp billboards to advertise this thing that supposedly everybody wants? It's almost like it's a con job going on through the government.
Yeah, absolutely.
Basically, it was interesting, though, because you had the dystopian feel and, you know, them advertising, go off planet and everything, and it just felt like it was the workers that were left. There was a movie a couple years ago, I don't remember the name of it, with Jodie Foster and Matt Damon.
Elysium.
And it had the same feel, that all was left was the lower class on Earth. And all the upper class wealthy people were all living in satellites or on other planets. And it had that same feel that Blade Runner had.
It's like an Elon Musk future.
And it could be that, you know, the Earth government, in whatever form it was, kind of thought, hey, if we can move some of these people off planet, we don't have to care for them.
Mm-hmm.
So it could have been just an advantage to get rid of them without really killing them or anything extreme like that.
But it really did seem like, I mean, everybody that Decker meets and his cast of characters, I mean, it does seem like this is, you know,
below the low.
Yeah. This is the hood. Like, Earth is the hood planet.
Yes.
It's the underworld.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
You kind of see that same school of thought in Metropolis, and that one.
I like what Mike said, though, comparing it to Star Trek, where that world is happening, but it's not the focus of this film. You know, it's like they do have interplanetary ability. They do have all these other things.
But they're not focusing on
it. But that's not what we're seeing. You know, we're seeing what's left.
No. If you want to see another world in the Blade Runner universe, watch Soldier.
That's what I was
going to say. Exactly. That's true.
Has anybody seen Soldier?
Love it.
Yeah. It's right. kind of...
When you're talking about the layers of how the film feels, Sid Mead actually said that he constructed the world. So it was like, what we're seeing is the dregs of the bottom basement, where everybody who is of influence or has money or is a middle class is actually living above something like the 106th floor of these buildings that we never quite see the top of, but we see them all neon lit.
No, it's perfect, actually.
It's worth pointing out that a lot of this is throughout all of Philip K. Dick's work. It's like bleak, dystopian, and not only that, but questioning the real basis of reality. What is reality? How does it fit in with what we see, what we think we see?
How does it translate now to 35 years later to what the world's like? How does it fit in? That's the big question.
Not enough neon light umbrella.
I was just thinking, I'm like, I mean, not enough neon.
You can't buy them, though.
I'm still waiting for the floating sushi stands.
Yeah. I think Think Geek was selling the neon light umbrellas for a while.
Yes, they were.
So you can check that out. Right. I think what's kind of fascinating.
So Blade Runner's world is a big Think Geek store?
Yeah, apparently.
Off-world. Got it.
But I think it's very interesting to see, you know, if you juxtapose the way the world is presented in Blade Runner, and then you see kind of directions that we could be heading in now, and you're like, well, that is a thing that could possibly happen, and that is possibly something we don't want to happen. Please. Thank you.
What got me about the 2049 trailer was I was excited to see daytime.
because we never got to see.
Yeah, that's true.
That's very true.
In the original film.
The sun.
Sun.
Exactly. It does exist.
Because it's either like twilight or sunset or just full on dark and rainy. And like sunlight, that exists still? Like,
no wonder everyone's depressed. They have sad.
where that really comes from, the darkness is from the visual style of the film noir films. What they would do typically is go have a fire truck go down a side street, you know, where they're filming, and just hose down everything. So they'd get all the sparkling glints of light off of the water on the pavement and the sidewalks and the buildings. That's the world of Blade Runner in 1949 instead of 2049.
We do see the sun at the very end, though, the last shot, right?
Well, Blade Runner? When they're in the snow, yeah. That's the only time you see it.
In the window, yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
It's there. It exists.
It's a very hazy. It looks like a very polluted.
But is the sun a replicant? That's the question.
Do you like our sun?
We made it. Yes, at Tyrell, we made our own sun.
It's an eclipsed sun.
So you talked about whether you prefer, you know, narration versus non-narration. How about the ending? You know, the ending of the theatrical version has, you know, Rachel magically has no expiration date, so they can go be happy ever after. That's left. in the director's cut, in the final cut, they just kind of go off together and you don't know what happens to them.
They go to the Overlook Hotel.
Yeah.
I like the ambiguity of it.
Yeah. Either way.
That whole relationship was just really weird.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with it having an expiration date because just the dynamics, like looking at it with a kind of 21st century, you know, feminist lens, you're like, that's a little bit weird for me as a woman watching it. Yeah. The dynamics are just all wonky. Yeah. So I'm okay with it kind of being ambiguous because I'm not really sure it was a good idea in the first place.
Yeah.
I mean, as much as you kind of like, wow, they're two attractive people that are going to be like mashing their faces and genitals together. That's really cool. But at the same time, it's like, I don't know if she's really that into it, dude.
She's not in any footage and in a trailer that I've seen, so I tend to think that she's not in it. But that could be because Sean Young's crazy.
Yeah, Sean Young took a left turn at Albuquerque.
So maybe that could be the other reason.
So are any of the panelists aware there's a Kickstarter project underway for a fan film called Slice of Life, and there's a trailer out for it, and it looks absolutely gorgeous. It's a Blade Runner fan film.
Oh, really? I don't know anything about it. That's
no,
cool.
That's awesome.
Google search for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
We definitely will put it in our show notes for that.
What was the title again?
Slice of Life.
Slice of Life.
They can do wonders with fan films.
Okay. We're passing the microphone down to the guy in the blue shirt.
Oh. I just want to talk about something else, which is one of the reasons why, well, this is my absolute favorite movie, is just how well it has stood up to the test of time. Because all the other sci-fi movies that I love that were made back in, you know, the late 70s or the early 80s, they look dated. So dated. And you can watch Blade Runner now, you can introduce it to new people, like a girlfriend here. We just recently watched it for the first time. And it still looks fresh. It still looks new. It looks as though it was made this year. And that's amazing. The big effect.
Yeah, that was really marvelous. Because again, I just, you know, as I kept, I watched it. And I watched it on my big, like, HD, you know, 4K TV. So yeah, it's going to look a little weird because it's a DVD. And this is not really meant for this. But it still looked pretty fantastic, all things considered, as far as the video quality. So that is really remarkable, especially, you know, considering the movie's age and what they had to work with.
I put this up there with 2001, basically, effect-wise. And thank you for clapping.
No,
but it's the same kind of effects. It's the same kind of ageless effects that fit. You know, sometimes even if you look at the first Star Wars or something, you could tell how dated some of the effects are in the movie. So not the what George has done since, but the original. I'm talking about the original version, and even like the original version of Close Encounters,
even the special edition.
Yeah, exactly. But Blade Runner doesn't feel that way. Blade Runner feels like the effects they use, the stories, and the way the look and feel, it just feels like it could be out today. And it's practical effects. It's not. It's pre-CGI. That's what's just most amazing about this movie, mm-hmm. is how much it carried through. And that was pretty darn awesome with it. And I'm looking forward to what they bring in the new movie. I'm scared as hell about the story.
I wanted to share my favorite tweet of the last several weeks, which was, what idiot decided to call it Blade Runner 2049 and not Blade Runner 2, Do Androids Dream of Electric Boogaloo?
You're awesome. That is the quote of the night, folks.
Yes. And on that note.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if we could do anything since. What's up?
I read secondhand that Harrison Ford was asked at. I heard that Harrison Ford was asked recently, possibly at San Diego Comic-Con, whether he thinks Deckard is a replicant or not. And in his inimitable style, he said, "I have no effing idea."
Right.
Do you think. Does authorial intent matter in this case? If Ridley Scott thinks Deckard is a replicant, does that mean Deckard is a replicant? Or do you think we can, our interpretation
I think Ridley made it ambiguous on purpose. I mean, even though he believed it himself and put some clues there to warrant that, but I think also he didn't enough to suggest that it wasn't, that he's not. And I gotta say, that's pretty brave on Ridley, because he could have hammered us, over the heads with it. And that's why, I'll make the statement here. I think this is Ridley Scott's best film. And that's, obviously says a lot for his career, but, and I'm a big Alien fan. So, but this just takes it to a whole different
level. It's a masterpiece.
It really is. It works on so many levels. And really is, like you said, it's timeless, because the way that he shot it, it just takes place in its own world, and you can watch it whenever. And it's just a beautiful movie.
Mm-hmm. I think Decker being a replicant or not being a replicant is very consistent with Philip K. Dick's ideas. So mm-hmm. he would have thoroughly approved, I think.
Yeah.
But I'll put it another way. Basically, I think there's an age limit where you could start with this movie. I tried showing this to William when he was like 13 or 14, because I thought it would be a good fit, because he liked the movies he liked. He fell asleep within the first 20 minutes of the film. And he's watched it more recently. He's almost 18 now. And he basically loves the film. He thought it was awesome. But it was funny, because he's also seen Red Dwarf Back to Earth, which totally cuts the second last episode is completely all Blade Runner. But in the Red Dwarf universe, and it was done, and William was like, "Dad, now I get that episode so much better."
He'll get a lot more references now.
When I watched it with my friends, and they brought their then 10, and I think their older one's like 13 or so. And I think my favorite, like, the kids would have, like, really random commentary, but my favorite quote of the night came from their dad saying, "Okay, so gunning her down the street didn't bother you, but the kissing does?" Yeah.
No, I totally see that. But it, so it makes me think, how much staying power is the new movie going to have? What kind of audience? Is it just going to be people who have a love affair with the first movie? Or is it going to...
A love affair with Ryan Gosling.
True. But is that enough to bring people into the screen? There's been...
Look, if they're
wonderful
if they're looking at three of these movies, they're really banking on this being a hit.
Three of them?
Are you saying, like, the first three movies?
Yeah.
No, I thought he said... Is it? I thought it was three prequels. Okay, I didn't think it was going to be three of these.
Well, look, they always want a sequel.
So. Oh, of course. But it's funny. For me, I didn't think this movie warranted a sequel.
No.
I think they should have ended it and that one and done.
To the point where I would like to see another movie in this universe.
Yes.
Do I need to see Decker again? No. So... The fact that he's showing up, I'm interested and I'm curious, but, like, if they said, we're going to do Blade Runner 2049, and it's not going to have Decker or any of the characters that you knew before, blah, blah, blah. I'd be like, fine, that's all right. This is going to be a whole thing, but it's awesome. So
This is Hollywood, where they sequelize My Favorite Martian and Leave It to Beaver, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Bewitched, you name it. Anything that's got a buck lying there somewhere that somebody can shell out to see. I hate to sound cynical, but that's what we've seen.
Yeah.
That's what we've seen. It's no reflection on us as the public, but that's what Hollywood is trying to squeeze out of everything that we love, everything we grew up with. So it doesn't bode well for Blade Runner or anything else, really.
Yeah.
But let's hope they're bucking the trend.
Well, somehow. That's a very interesting opinion to take, considering when the First World War was released, it was considered a huge failure.
Mm-hmm.
So for Warner Brothers and for everybody to go back 35 years later and say, we're going to make a sequel to something that did not make us any money at the time, in fact, is actually a rather brave move. But
in their eyes, they're going to fix it.
Sorry?
In their eyes, they're going to fix it.
Well, I think Ridley Scott already fixed it. That's the thing. But going back to the idea of the lady was saying about Deckard being a replica and Ridley Scott having the force of opinion, Harrison Ford has always maintained that, in his opinion, Deckard was not a replicant. And even when they were going into 2049 and the first big photograph was released of Denis Villeneuve and Ryan Gosling and Ford and Scott, Gosling was saying that even now, get Scott and Ford in a room together and they will be at loggerheads, because Scott will still maintain that Deckard is a replicant, and Ford, being a former philosophy major at university, will still maintain that Deckard is a human. Because that's one of the reasons why he did the film. It just really went into that teaching that he went through.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have time for one more question. So, right there. You get the last question, sir.
So, before the next movie comes out, my wife has never seen Blade Runner. I've been actually trying to contemplate the final cut or the narration, only because I think the narration helps understand it a little bit if you don't get it, but I also know that the final cut is probably the superior. That's what I would watch now. So I would just maybe like a vote of just for a brand new newcomer, same age as me. And I understand, like you said, the narration has its issues, but I kind of like it too. The ending, it goes either way, but the narration I kind of like. So,
ever watched Final Cut twice?
Well, we'll get to it maybe in 5 years later.
So how many versions do you think they're going to be doing of 2049?
As many as are necessary.
How many can they get people to pay for?
Exactly. That's true. That's very true. Any final thoughts from the panelists up here before we wrap up?
Nothing for me.
Nothing? Sir?
Mm. Well, just hope for the best. Expect the worst.
Hope it's better than the Tron sequel.
I like the Tron sequel.
That was at least
okay.
The Tronster abides.
Too soon.
You know what? No matter what happens with it, the original is still one of the best movies ever. It's never going to change that for me. So I'm glad that we have the original.
Yay!
And I'm glad we have the director's cut too.
Scotty, when it's coming out?
November.
No, October.
Is it October?
Ooh, yeah, it's like October 8th or something like that.
Woo!
Yes. Yeah.
Let's start lining up now.
Yeah.
It comes out
30
years.
Yeah. Scotty,
I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be one of the things I'm hoping to do opening night and just have a lot of fun.
Cool. All right, at the end.
I'm really glad that I finally got to sit down and watch, and I got to watch it with some great friends who'd also never seen the movies.
So are you going to wait for 35 years to watch the sequel?
Are you excited for the sequel?
I'm excited for the sequel. Like, I kind of want to see what they do with it next. Okay. I'm not going to wait, gosh, how many years? Like, about 30-something years to see it. So I will actually probably see this maybe when it's in theaters.
Yay! Wow. Ooh, wow. Thank you guys very much for joining us. Remember, if you enjoyed us, leave it on the app. 5 stars. If you didn't enjoy it, 5 sarcastic stars. If not, we're Nerdist. Let's just do it. We are Earth Station 1. We can be found at esopodcast.com. Please listen to us. We'd love it. Thank you. Hey, gang. It's Mike. I'm slowly recovering from Dragon Con, but you could tell through my voice I kind of like overdid it. And so far, no con crud, but let's cross our fingers on that one. As a bonus, we're giving you 3 interviews we did at the show. The first one up will be voice actor extraordinaire Rob Paulsen. He's known for his work on Animaniacs, Pinky and the Brain, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and so much more. His interview has a slight delay at the beginning of it, so it had started already in progress. The second interview we have is with actor Neil McDonough from shows like Justified, Arrow, Legends of Tomorrow, and The Band of Brothers. And last but not least are actors Mallory Jensen and Brad Dalton from the TV show Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Hope you enjoy it. Also, before I'm out of here, please remember to join us next week when we'll be wrapping up our summer movie predictions and we see how we actually did and who ended up with egg on their face. Also, in that episode, we'll be looking at our fall TV season and what's going to be a hit, what's going to be a miss, at least according to us. As always, thanks so much for listening. We appreciate so much your support. And please, enjoy the interviews.
Conventions that were kind enough to invite me and that I had developed a note on my vocal cords, which was not quite the truth. I had a couple of nodes, but they were cancerous tumors instead of nodes on my vocal cords in my throat. But they were, are taken care of. I'm not a smoker. It's just one of those things.
Genetics or something?
Not genetics. It was, it's kind of a something, a cancer that unfortunately is becoming more and more prevalent, caused by the HPV virus, the human papillomavirus. Mm-hmm. And, I had no pain. I was working. I had a lump in my neck for about a year. A typical guy, you know. I'm like, if I'm not dying, I don't go to the doctor. So I went to my my internist for my yearly physical. And man, 5 seconds, he put his hand on that lump, and it was a swollen lymph node. And he said, "That's not good." And I said, "Oh, come on." You know, I said, "No, but I don't feel it. Trust me, it's not good." So this was the area to which the cancer had spread. It was already in my throat and a small tumor that they couldn't see until they did a bunch of biopsies. So that really got my attention. But anyway, to make a long story short, I'm fine. I had to go through a pretty gnarly regimen, and they told me right up front, it's going to kick your ass, you're going to live, but you know, you'll die someday, but not from this if we get it now. But it's going to really be pretty onerous, and it was. But I chose not to tell the truth or not to really make a big deal out of it because you guys, everybody's got their shit. Everybody's got stuff. I don't need anybody's sympathy. I am incredibly fortunate. Even if they had said, you know, you better pack your stuff up because you're getting ready to punch your ticket, I'd had a hell of a run. I've had an amazing run to this point. I wasn't interested in dying, but I had nothing to seek sympathy about. So I just chose to cancel the conventions at which I had been invited and tell them I had a, you know, an issue with my vocal cords. And then once I started doing cons at the end of last year, it was pretty obvious that I'd lost 50 pounds. You know, people were saying, God, no offense, but you were not exactly a giant guy to begin with, and you look really thin. Are you okay? And I said, well, I am now. But here's what happened. So that's why I talked about it, because now I'm in a position where I can help people. Now I'm in a position where I might be able to, you never know whose ear you might catch on a podcast or an interview and say, wow, Rob Paulsen makes his living doing cartoon voices, and he got through throat cancer of all things. And so I can figure out how to get through my stuff. So thank you for asking, and thank you for your kind words. I'm fine. I'm just still trying to put on some weight. But otherwise, I'm those doctors, I'll be damned. They saved my voice, and I'm incredibly fortunate. Very lucky.
Well, it's interesting because I didn't hear about it until you came out on your podcast.
Podcast, yeah. That was the official, that was like January of this year.
Right.
Yeah.
And see, I lost my mom to cancer, so.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
To hear you talk about it so frankly, because you were completely honest, it sounded like.
Totally. Oh, yeah, I had nothing to hide. I, you know, if you choose to, well, let me back up a little bit. Any actor who says they don't like attention is lying to you. Now, that doesn't mean that they like to be bothered 24/7. I'm not Brad Pitt. I don't know what it's like to not be able to go to the 7-Eleven without, you know, a mob or Tom Cruise or whatever. The characters on which I work, I don't draw them and I don't write them. I got to make that clear. The characters on which I'm fortunate enough to work are famous. I'm the one who gets the glory because I'm the voice of the characters, and people love that, and I love it. But I am absolutely open and honest because I chose to be an actor. And to the extent you people are kind enough to speak to me and that cultivates some sort of celebrity, I asked for it. So to get to a place where you go, no, I don't want to talk about that, that's fine, and it is personal. But I believe that the whole shooting match, if you're lucky enough to gain some celebrity, which results in a lot of great things for people who become famous, you know, you get tables at restaurants, nice people like you want to talk to me, people ask me to sign autographs, I can talk to their kids. So with that, I believe, comes a certain amount of responsibility to be able to talk about the, you know, everybody has bad days. Everybody has bad months. Everybody in the world, unfortunately, will be touched by cancer. You, very clearly. And it's painful. But that's part of the deal, man. If I'm lucky enough to get to this position, I want to be able to talk to people about it. So there was never a moment that I didn't want to share it. I just wanted to share it when I was through with it because I didn't want to spend months thanking people every day because I know how many people out there are so kind and sweet. If I told them that, they would, via Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all day. I hope you're okay, Mr. Paulson. I lost my mother, I lost my father, I lost my brother, and I would want to respond to them, and I didn't have the juice. I was just a wreck for about 2 or 3 months. So anyway, that's why I was very upfront about it, and I hope I can help.
I was reading that, you know, your doctor told you it would take you two years to kind of get back up to full speed. So what are you working on now? I know there's been a lot of rumors about the Animaniacs reboot.
Man, and from your lips to God's checkbook. I think it's about time for those assholes to get back to work, don't you?
In
fact, I put a little picture of the water tower on Twitter, I think it was, or Instagram the other day, and said, I think it's about time for Yakko Wakko and Dot to get back to work. And that was on the heels, not on the heels, but a couple months ago. You probably read that IndieWire article that came out that was floated by Amblin. And all I know is there have been pretty fervent discussions about the fact that Animaniacs is enormous on Netflix. It's doing great business. I also know, having had the great good fortune of working with Mr. Spielberg on a number of occasions, that he is inarguably the most powerful man in Hollywood, and if he wants to get something done, he'll get it done. I also know from the experience with him that if he gets it done, it will be at a very high level. It's not going to be just to do it for the sake of doing it. It won't be done unless it's done well. And when that little IndieWire article was floated, it looked like it was pretty legitimate in terms of the desire to put, you know, the talks are in place to get it done. Because nothing goes out without Mr. Spielberg's approval with his name on it. And if his name on it is on it and he doesn't have his approval, it's out. There's pushback right away, and there's no pushback. So my feeling is that they are definitely talking between Amblin and Warner Brothers with probably one of the new platforms to do it, because Animaniacs is huge still, and Pinky and the Brain. Now, whether or not they'll use Yakko and Wakko, I mean, Tress and Jess and myself and Maurice, is certainly up to them. It's their dime, and they can do whatever they like. I hope they do, for obvious reasons, but I think there's also a fan base that would probably be pretty disappointed that they didn't use the original actors, because we're all young enough to do it, and we do it all the time. And so, trust me, I know you guys probably follow me on Twitter and all that other stuff, and once I get the word, if it's happening, you'll know pretty quickly. And I have a feeling that the excitement about a reboot of Animaniacs and or Pinky and the Brain would be a really big deal for a while, you know. So my little cartoon fingers are crossed.
It's always nice because you still have a direct relationship with all the voice actors mm-hmm. that you worked with. You know, you and Maurice all the time to see you guys together, and especially here at Dragon Con or other cons around the country, and some of the script readings and stuff
that. Those are a blast.
I loved when you did the Pulp Fiction one.
Wasn't that great? That was with Phil LaMarr.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was just a couple weeks ago. And I got to thank Nerdist. I have they've taken my podcast and turned it into a pretty fun little TV show, and it's really great, you know. And the little clips that we've released, myself singing Yakko's World and the new lyric with the new Countries of the World part of it, and Kevin Conroy was on my show and had a little clip of that from Dark Knight. Yeah, those things have got like 8 or 9 million views in the last few weeks. It's pretty cool. So the fan love is there, and there's no place that it is more obvious than Dragon Con. Everybody here could not be nicer to me, and I'm so grateful that I not only get to come back anywhere because of the whole cancer thing, but especially here. Everybody's just delightful, and I have a little chunk of my cartoon heart in Atlanta for these folks. They're all just really delightful.
That's awesome.
We have time for one more quick question.
One
quick
one.
When you're not doing interviews or signing autographs, what do you like to do at Dragon Con?
Well, it's interesting, Kelly. Years ago, I was just saying this to my wife the other day. I'm a golf nutter. I have been for years. I'm playing golf and hockey, being a Yankee from Michigan. You couldn't tell, right? Detroit Tigers. I love hockey, and I love golf. But I have to say, after when I was at the end of my cancer treatment, I couldn't play. I couldn't really do anything for about 2 or 3 months. It's just the radiation just kicks your ass. And I still have a few problems with, you know, my weight and endurance. But as you mentioned, it's going to take another year. I'm a year done now. It'll take me another year to kind of fill out. Fair trade. But when I was convalescing and getting back on my feet, I was working on all the things that are starting to come to fruition now, like my little Nerdist show, trying to find out what to do with my podcast. And I have to say, the universe opened up. When I was ready to do it, Chris Hardwick and the folks at Nerdist said, hey, how about doing your show as an on-camera show? It's great, and it's doing really well on the Nerdist Alpha Network. I think it's a combination between Nerdist and Geek and Sundry. And more conventions. I'm doing another half a dozen this year. I am directing a new animated show that I can't tell you about yet because they're going to make an announcement with the new about the show, and that I'm working on it. So I'm directing now. I'm still working on traditional cartoon stuff for Disney and Nickelodeon and Warner Brothers with my traditional go to work and make funny noises gig. Randy Rogel and I have got a deal with Warner Brothers licensing by which we take the music of Animaniacs and play it all around the country.
Are you going to do it here in Atlanta?
I hope so, man. We've got it booked. We've already done 4 or 5 gigs. We've got another 10 booked into next year. And I'll tell you what, if there's an Animaniacs announcement to do the show again, that would really light a candle under orchestras and symphonies because we've got the mechanism already in place. So we're doing a lot of that. I love the live performing. The audiences at the Animaniacs live shows are 10 years old to 70. It's unbelievable. So honestly, now I don't have time to play golf, which is fine because I love working. I love golf, but I love working a lot more. And so I'm really anxious to, you know, keep all that stuff going and hopefully keep giving, as they say, giving the people what they want. And they sure have given me what I want. I cannot imagine getting any more love and support from a fan base. I really appreciate the opportunity to let people know how much I really appreciate how supportive they are. I'm the luckiest guy. You were looking at a lottery winner. Trust me, I'm a lucky man. So thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you, Rob.
I appreciate it. And I'm going to go do another one.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Neil.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, okay. Have a great one.
That's right.
How's Dragon Con been for you so far?
It's not like any other con I've ever been to in so much that there's no real theme to it. So everyone can dress as they want or not dress. Mm-hmm. Everyone can express themselves freely, if you know, and everyone's kind of like, hey, that's cool. And I love that. I wish life was more like that, where there's less judging about, oh, you're wearing this, or you're doing this, or you look like this, or here. It's all open. It's all fun. And I think that's a really neat environment to be part of.
Is this your first one?
First one, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really, and it's in Atlanta, which is an awesome town.
It is.
Yeah. So me being a devout baseball fan, you know, the Braves one time came from my hometown, Boston.
True.
So I've always had this affinity to Atlanta, which is pretty funny.
You should try, if you get a chance, check out the new stadium.
I've tried, but they're out of town. I was here doing Survivor's Remorse a couple of months ago.
Right.
And I want to go see a Braves game, but they were out of town that weekend. I'm like, and I come along, I'm going to see the Braves this weekend. This is going to be great. Out of town again. No! So I might just have to come down. And
there's so much filming down here nowadays, you probably could.
It's amazing. The two most popular places to film are Atlanta and Vancouver, where I now live.
Right.
And, you know, we lived in Los Angeles for quite some time, but you know, it's a choice now for actors. You either move to Atlanta or you move to Vancouver.
Right.
And my shows, Legends, Flash, right. Arrow, they all shoot up in Vancouver. But you know, to live in Atlanta would be an awesome thing also. It's such a great place and great environment, great sports scene, great theater, great concerts, great people and the food.
Both cities actually very similar.
Very, very, very similar, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What do you like about playing Damien?
What don't I like about playing Damien? You know, I can do anything I want. You know, it's, you know, they give me these fantastic outfits to wear. I never have to wear a mask. Never have to have that flowing cape. Never have to put on any stuff. I just get to be. I don't even have to have a gun. You know, so I'm not strapped down with any props or any confinements of wardrobe. It's just freeing. And then the words that they give me that I get to play with. Come on, it's you know, it's been really, you know, the joy of my life to jump into this whole universe. You know, thanks to Greg Berlanti and Mark Guggenheim, who writes me the greatest stuff. It's been such an absolute blessing to be part of it.
You must have loved it last season on Legends, where you got to wear the Don Johnson outfit.
Oh, everyone today is like, my favorite thing last year was watching you in the white suit. And it was, but I wish we were shooting that scene in Atlanta, because we were shooting it there. I was in the white suit with the white flip-flops, and there's the Ferrari, and there's a cigarette boat behind me, and I think it was 42 degrees outside.
Oh.
So I was drinking hot coffee just before the take, so the breath would come out of my mouth during my close-up. So mm-hmm. You can see, I was like, wait a minute, what's breathy in Miami? That doesn't make sense. That's when I wish I was in Atlanta filming. But I have a pretty good feeling I'll be filming more and more in Atlanta just because of the situation with the tax breaks and everything else, and I'm really looking forward to spending more time here.
All the studios popping up.
It's crazy. It's like Vancouver was for over the last 25 years, well, Atlanta caught up fast, you know, and what they're doing here, what your governor's done, and, you know, all the elected officials just ensuring that business is not so much in, you know, in Louisiana as it was for so many years. It's now come to Georgia, which is terrific. And, you know, I love filming in New Orleans and Baton Rouge and Shreveport all those years, but now everything's switched over here to Georgia, and I couldn't be happier. I'm looking forward to spending a lot of time here.
That's awesome.
So have you been subject to a John Barrowman prank at all?
John's definitely scared of me. We keep on joking on the set. We keep on singing Ebony and Ivory because that's who we are. We're, you know, like two totally different things. We're the odd couple, you know, and it works so well on screen because we're so different in our approaches to so many things. But there's also, you know, a brothership there that I love John dearly. He's, you know, now become one of my, you know, greatest friends, and, you know, the respect that we have for each other is really fantastic. But no, he wouldn't dare do a prank on me because he'd scare himself.
The chemistry between the two of you is amazing in the scenes that you had both on Legends and also on Arrow. It was just, you guys almost felt like you guys were eating up the screen, and everyone else disappeared in a lot of ways.
It was, you know, I think Legends last year was trying to figure out what it was. And the first year, there were a bunch of hiccups. And the second year, starting the season off, it was also, they were trying to figure out exactly what the show was, because Arrow was so definitive and Flash was so definitive. Flash was really a family show. Arrow is a very dark superhero show. Both awesome in their execution. And Legends, they were trying to figure out, okay, what's really this show? And then when they put John, myself, and Matt together, you know, the Legion of Doom, instead of being overly dark, we made it incredibly light and funny.
Oh, sure.
In really the most bizarre of situations. And I think the studio was like, oh, wait a second, I think we kind of figured out what's going on here with Legends. And ever since then, Legends has just been Disneyland, you know, mm-hmm. the happiest place on earth for a bad guy. And they let us, you know, run amok, you know, and we've had such a wonderful time playing against each other. And the three of us are so different. But in John and I in particular, it works. You know, we've been working together for a couple of years now, and there's a rapport, and there's also, when we come to the set, it's game day. You know,
sure.
Everyone's geared up, everyone is ready, and I'm always 100% prepared. And to meet someone else who is like myself, who's also 100% prepared, we're ready to rumble, which allows you to improv, because you know your words, you know everything, you're ready to rumble, you have all the confidence, and then you get to create on the set. And it's, you know, it's been really just magic between the two of us on screen.
That's awesome. It was really good. Are you filming already for the next season?
Yeah, I started last week. I start on episode 5. It's a slow burn up to Damien, and then when Damien's on, it's for the rest of the season, it's me assembling a new team and how I'm going to... It's a little more darker this year, I think, in tone than it was last year, just because John's not on the show yet this year. I'm not sure when he's coming back. But John's off doing many other things. But you know, right now it's you know, it's great to be back on Legends, and the right out of the shoot when they bring me back to life, which I'm not going to give away too many story points, but when they bring me back to life in episode 5, you can just see the absolute joy on my face when they resuscitate me, and it's just, it's on. You know, it's just going to be a blast of a season.
One of the things I liked about Damien's character is you're a villain, but you think you're doing the right thing.
Absolutely.
And that's a true villain, you know, a true great character.
Yeah.
Is somebody you're thinking you're doing the best for everybody else.
Yeah.
And it might hurt some people, but in the long run, it's going to be the best for humanity.
There's always going to be casualties to get to greatness. And that's basically the theme for all these sociopaths over time who have ruled the world in different... You know, whether it be Hitler, whether it be Mussolini, whether it be, you know, whomever you choose as the dark leader, they think that their quest is just. Mm-hmm. And for Damien, I think what I'm doing is I'm saving the world. I'm getting rid of the bad apples. And if I'm the only apple left, well, that's fine, because I'll just start the whole world all over again. That's quite a mindset to have. And for an actor, it's, well, I can do anything I want. And the more I truly believe it, and the more I... you know, let it really come into my being as an actor, the more freeing it is, the more truthful it is, which makes it so much scarier.
Sure.
And I think that's why on Arrow, Damien was incredibly dark and scary, because that was, you know, playing opposite Steven, who's very dark himself and very
intense.
You know, he's very driven in his character. I was also the same way. And when I see him unraveling, it gave me such... pause for happiness to watch him unravel a bit in front of me,
right.
And knowing that I was going to win. Obviously, I was going to win. Nothing can stop Damien Dark.
Being a time travel show, is it fun going to? I mean, because your sets are changing every week.
Sword fighting with Brandon in the middle of a snowstorm.
That was awesome.
In heavy armor and chainmail and such was awesome. I mean, that was cinematic. You know, glory. It was, we had so much fun doing that. And then the next episode was someplace else, or, you know, I'm on a horse, or I'm flying through something, or
Chicago.
Or Chicago, yeah.
Oh, the gangster episode.
The gangster episode was just awesome. And the guy who played Al Capone was just spot on perfect. But mm-hmm. it's been a ton of fun playing Damien Dark, because, again, they just let me loose.
Sure. I'm going to take a step.
For one more question.
Okay. Can I?
Yeah, you bet.
The first time I remember seeing you on screen was the Star Trek movie mm-hmm. that you did. And loved Hawk. I thought he was
great.
A great character. Did they let you know that it was just a one-and-done role?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah, well, I knew I was going to die at the end.
Okay.
Yeah. And I had a blast, you know. And to see the guys here today, you know, I hadn't seen them in quite some time. I hadn't seen Dorney in probably 20 years. And, you know, I hadn't seen... Frakes in quite some time, and to see those guys. So that was my first big movie role.
Sure.
And, you know, and Jonathan Frakes gave me my first shot at it, and it was something I'll always look back on very fondly. It was a great time, and yeah, I knew I was going to die. I was the red shirt pilot of the night. You know, And I think when I got the part, Jonathan said to me, congratulations, you're flying the ship, and also you're dying at the end of the movie. I'm like, fine, great, they'll remember me even more. And it was great to, and then to work with Patrick was just, my first day on the set, I asked if I could come early, and they said, you know, because I wanted to sit on the Enterprise for a while myself and kind of absorb it. And they said, sure, how much earlier? And I think they thought like 10 minutes. I was like, I don't know, like 3-4 hours? And they're like, okay. Like, literally, the janitors are there at 6 o'clock in the morning over at Paramount, and I walk onto the flight, and I'm sitting there for hours, and I'm pretending I'm Shatner. I'm pretending I'm Picard. And I think I was doing Picard when I heard behind me, you must be a hawk. And I turn around, and it's Patrick Stewart, who was an hour early himself, who will also like to hang out at the Enterprise. And it was just awesome, you know, and to be part of cinematic history like that, it was, awesome. it was really, and ever since then, it's been a heck of a ride for Neil McDonough.
Cool. Well, thank you so much.
Yep, thank you. Mike. Appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Enjoy the rest of the con.
We will, absolutely. Thank you.
Well, we appreciate you guys doing this. It's been a weird day of scheduling, so we really appreciate both of you guys doing this. Yeah. This is
welcome to DragonCon.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Can we start with impressions of DragonCon? What you think about the convention? How it compares to others? And
hi, I'm DragonCon. Sorry. Well,
I'd like to say that's going to be the last joke that you're going to hear. But they keep coming.
It's actually my first DragonCon. One of my first conventions, actually.
Oh, really?
So, I don't have much to compare it to, but I feel like I've been thrown in the deep end.
You have.
It's huge. And you know what? I love it because it's just so electric. Everyone is in a great mood. There's so many like great costumes out there. And I love it. I've had a really great time being here. What about you, Brett?
What she said?
Yeah.
No, I think that this is my second time, second year in a row doing DragonCon, and it has like all of the spirit and energy of San Diego without quite the madness of it. Well, there's madness of it too.
Yeah.
But I love it. It's one of my favorite ones. I'm very happy that they invited me back. It's all fan run. Everyone here is a legit.
Yeah.
Fan who really wants to see you. And then the party never stops.
Yeah.
It's like a nonstop party for 4 days.
Oh, pretty much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in your hotel lobby, even when you're trying to go back and get some sleep, it's still happening.
That's crazy.
So, but it's incredible. It's incredible to be just caught up in the energy of it. I got this hat.
Where did you get
Mallory,
that? I just noticed you were holding it.
Because I know that.
Because I'm a pirate.
I had one as well, and I know that you were very jealous when other people wear hats next to you. So.
I'm surprised it fits my big head. Yeah. I have a naturally large head. But it fits. I'm not going to keep that on. No. I know it's cute and everything.
All right.
You look like Captain Cook.
Yeah, Captain Cook. There you go. A little Aussie reference.
Aussie.
Oh, yes.
So with, this is for Brett, with Ward being one of the best, in my opinion, one of the better written villains. And
you could say best.
We actually call you Darth Ward, like Darth Vader.
I've been called worse.
Where do you think, is there a chance, and I know you can't go into anything, you can't say anything, what would you like to see if Ward came back? What would you like to see? Would you like to see him on the right side or his side?
Oh. Any side. The alive side? I mean, anything. I was very thankful for the redemption arc in Framework because I think it gave, first of all, me another chance to explore Ward because I was kind of sad when Coulson did the bad thing on Mavis and killed me with his robot hand. So it was good. I wasn't really ready to give up the character, and it felt like the audience wasn't as well. And it was really nice. It felt like they were watching or they were reading fan fiction and listening to the audience. And so there was a chance for Skyward to come back together. There was a chance for the Ward that we know and love to still be the Ward that we know and love. But as you said, he was kind of on the right side. He was using all of his tools for good rather than evil. So that was good to explore, that was good to portray, and it felt like that was something that really landed with the audience as well. So, I mean, in answer to your question, should they call, I'll pick up the phone.
Automatic.
That actually leads into my next question for you, because you come back multiple times. Each time you die or such, do they say that's it, and then they call you a couple months later? Hey, do you want to come back? How's that work?
I think that they give me the same treatment that they gave.
We both got the same treatment.
Young Mallory here, which is you're just Marvel dead.
We all know what that means.
Gotcha. No,
but I mean, they actually did follow through with me. Some people, not so much. But no, I'm just kidding.
We don't know yet. Okay.
I know. But you know, they said that actually for many of the characters who've been on our show, you know, hey, there's always a chance. You never know, and it's true. Our whole show is based on a guy who was killed in the films.
Sure.
So we know that it can happen, and they actually did follow through. I mean, they waited to the last minute to follow through with me. I'm just saying, they had a whole season four go on, and I was like, this is never going to happen. It's just never going to happen. How could they possibly? And then they found a way. So they're incredible writers. They know exactly what they're doing, and I hope they find a way to bring us both back.
Yeah.
I mean, with the tag in first season five, it seems like they're kind of going intergalactic, possibly. Yeah. I don't know. They don't send us scripts anymore. But, you know, it seems like that's where they're going, and possibly for a bigger setup. And with Inhumans, obviously, that doesn't take place on Earth. So there's a lot of stuff happening. And I think that if they can possibly find a way to bring us back, I imagine they would. Or certainly, you know... That's why I keep sending them gift baskets every
year. Wine.
I hope that's not wasted money.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm still out here.
Yeah. just drop into the writer's room. Hey, guys. Yeah.
Both of you guys ostensibly were helping S.H.I.E.L.D. at first, and then were Hydra at various times. Has that been fun to kind of play both sides and, you know, see both sides of your character?
Yeah. It's always fun. It's always fun to, like... you know, find different sides of any character. And yeah, like for me, you know, I started off like playing Ada, and it was, I thought it was brilliant playing AI. It was such a cool experience, and, you know, finding little things and little movements and just, and everything like that. But then, you know, going from her to Madame Hydra and then to, you know, Agnes and, you know, finding different facets in every character, but still it's, you know, it's Ada. And then, you know, being part of Hydra is pretty cool. Like, there's a lot of Hydra fans here, I've found. You know, you just walk past them and they're like, Al Hydra. You're like, yeah.
There's no call and response, though. What do you say after that?
I never really know. Yay!
Yes!
Yeah! Yeah, it's been pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And we get to wear awesome costumes.
I was just going to say, well, they have the best costumes,
they
do. Don't they?
Yes, they do. I agree with that.
Have you seen anyone cosplay as you guys yet?
Yes, yeah. What about Hydras?
Yeah,
I did see. That's why I was asking.
Yes, there's been a few. I mean, it's a good one. You get to play with the green hair and, like, a cape. And, I love seeing people, you know, dress up as your character. It's, you know, it really makes you feel like, oh, they resonated with someone, and they went to the effort of putting this together. So it's very cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. You have all the characters they could have chose.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Have you had any cosplayers today?
No.
Oh.
I wish I had something funny to say. But no. No, not today. I have had them, but
I'm sure,
not
yeah.
today. You don't have to patronize me. Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure they're around.
It's okay.
Maybe sometime
one
this
day.
Year.
I was at the panel yesterday, and you said that when you were hired, you didn't know everything that was going to happen with your character. So my question for you is, when you were hired, did you know Ward was going to be evil?
Abso-effing no. No. Not at all.
Well, follow up to that. Since you've been good and bad on the show, I just saw Gavin Stone, and it was really, really funny.
Oh, thank you.
Do you have any more, like, comedy in the future?
You're like one
different?
Of 50 people that have seen it. I'm kidding. I love the film. I wish more people saw it.
Yeah.
Dallas, if you're listening, I love it. Because I think it's a good film that not a lot of people have seen. I would like to. I mean, this was a stretch for me to be cast in this. Mm-hmm. I think that most of the people that I've trained with and worked with, when they found out, they're like, you got cast as a superhero? Okay. How's that going to work? Because I think, you know, in grad school, you're wearing sweatpants and, you know, you're not in the best shape and you're rolling around and, I don't know, doing stuff.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they needed me in shape and they needed me to be this ultra serious guy. And I'm not typically used to being cast that way. So, this, I feel like, was a stretch. Actually, the movie that you saw, Gavin Stone, was pretty close to who I am in real life. So I felt like for that, I didn't have to do a lot of acting. And I mean that in the best way. I felt like, you know, it was a pretty big departure because the character that most people are used to seeing me as is so serious. I think people, at least in the beginning, were like, I don't know how to take you because I've been seeing you killing people and doing all this other stuff that you probably shouldn't be doing. And then now I see you and you seem like a nice guy, but I don't know if I trust you. So, yeah. I hope that there's a future in comedy. Somebody said that I could be the next John Hamm. It was myself and it was 5 minutes ago. You know, I appreciated the comedy. So we'll see.
Thank you. One more question, guys.
Wow. Wow. Nice. All right.
It's so much
really?
Pressure. It's just too much pressure.
Yeah. Well, I'll say you could be the next John Hamm.
So
someone else said it now.
Now it's
a rumor.
It's catching
on. Oh, man. It is really catching on. Yes.
Wildfire.
Actually, I do got a question. How did they describe for both of you the characters when, you know, when they auditioned for your roles?
No, we both just did the at the same time.
I thought you were going to go, and then you thought I was going to go.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
Yeah. Well,
I got my role first. So.
With me, I didn't really know too much at all when I auditioned. They gave me dummy sides, which were basically just, you know, put together, nothing to do with the actual storyline. And they just said, you're an artificial intelligence, you're like a robot, so just be, you know, as robotic as possible. And I did my best. And they said, okay, one more time.
Turn it
now
off
more.
Now.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God.
Sorry.
But yeah, it was, I really didn't know anything, to be honest. I just did what I thought was right, and thank God it worked out.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
They described Grant Ward as a specialist. Without any people skills. I'm sort of paraphrasing, but that was it. He was a specialist. He could do anything with combat and weapons and all of that stuff, but he didn't work well with others. Yeah. And so there wasn't much to go on outside of that. And, the rest is history.
There you go. And here we are.
At DragonCon.
DragonCon.
Thank you guys very much.
Thank you, guys.
You've been listening to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast that explores the many worlds of all things geek. Please write us at esopodcast@gmail.com or call us at 404-963-9057. And if we find what you say interesting, we'll put it up on the air. If you've enjoyed our show, please rate us or leave feedback for us up on iTunes. And while you're there, subscribe to our show or any of the ESO Network podcasts. We can also be found up on Stitcher Radio or wherever fine podcasts are found. ESO is also available up on most social media sites like Facebook, Twitter, and so many more. The show is brought to you by the fine folks at the ESO Amazon.com e-store, where right from our website you can find all kind of geeky goodness, and if you get something up there, you also help support the station. ESO also has a Zazzle store to buy cool ESO merchandise and such. Show your ESO love with something from Zazzle. To learn more about ESO, our website is esopodcast.com. The show is produced by Calico Productions. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you here next time on the Earth Station 1 podcast. Peace.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.